This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. 2017 has not been a good year for the Mecklenburg County Health Department. In February, it was revealed that the department failed to notify about 200 women who had questionable pap smear results. Ultimately, that led to the resignation of Health Director Marcus Plusha, who continues to maintain that the department did provide quality care. But now an internal review takes issue with that claim. Then, just before the start of the summer swimming season, it was revealed that the department had failed to inspect a number of public pools, even some of those that had previously been issued safety violations. Now the department is struggling to regain the public's trust. So we're going to spend the first part of the program today examining the health of the health department. Fred Clayson Kelly has been following this story since the very beginning for the Charlotte Observer. He joins us in our Spirit Square studio along with Jim Puckett, the vice chairman of the Mecklenburg County Commission. He represents District 1. Welcome back to you both. Good morning.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Nice to have you here. And with us by phone is Mecklenburg County District 4 Commissioner Dumont Clark. Mr. Clark, welcome back.
Hello.
By the way, we invited outgoing Health Director Marcus Plusha to be with us. He thanked us for the offer but declined, saying he would be on vacation this week, but would leave open the opportunity to discuss the situation at a later date. And we also invited County Manager Dina DiOrio. She, too, is on vacation and could not suggest a suitable alternative to represent county management. But we have Jim Puckett and Dumont Clark. They can represent the county rather well, I would think. And if you'd like to join our conversation, you can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook or get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. We're also broadcasting on Facebook Live this morning. Fred, take us back to when this story first broke in February. When, how, and why did you guys become aware of this problem involving the agency's failure to notify these women who had uncertain pap smear results?
We became involved in February, probably about 3 or 4 days before this all broke on February 21st for us. We got a call from a person whose identity I can't reveal, who had information on what was going on in the health department, and felt very strongly that there may be people whose health and lives were at risk, and that the county management was not being fully forthcoming about the facts and the danger that these women might be in.
Because the media is under attack regularly today, and one of the points of attack are these unnamed sources. Explain to me why you would trust this person that you cannot name.
I would trust them because they're in a very good position to verify the information that they provided to us. Almost all, I'd say 99.5% of the information they have provided to us has ultimately been confirmed and vindicated in a public fashion. We've gotten information from a number of sources within the department, some of it from the very upper reaches of the organization concerned about what's going on. And it's come in the form of emails. It's come in the form of calls. It's come in the form of recordings of people talking in the department. And I would stand by all of our reporting. I know there's been some discussion about it on social media and in the halls of county government. But I firmly believe in everything we've reported. And as I said before, it's all been vindicated.
And was this the first indication of trouble under the leadership of the then health director, Marcus Plusha?
It wasn't the first signs of trouble. He came in with a very strong reputation, had worked for the CDC and for the state. But the health department is a very difficult agency to manage. They have wide-ranging duties, ranging from providing health care to regulating pools and child care and restaurants. I would say most people would agree he had a very strong first year, but there were some fissures starting in 2015. There were people who felt like he did not take advice from nurses and other people in the agency. He was warned by people in upper management that if he was not careful, that things would fall apart, that there were racial schisms within the department. There were a number of employees unhappy about their pay and their promotions and their ranks.
Which leads to this question, Jim Puckett. How long did it take you at the county commission level? Because you essentially are the health department. The county commission...
In a convoluted manner.
We're not the health department. No. We are the board of...
The board of health. Exactly. Well, how long did it take you? Because you found out about this in February as well. How long did it take you to determine how much of this was accurate versus interagency politics?
Well, the county manager let us know in mid-January to early February when the public knew out. I had heard some rumblings of this. I suspect that Fred and I have the same people calling us, and again verified by it. But it was the first of the year before the county commission found out about this, which is some of my concern. Because going back to what Fred said, there were actually inter-department emails and issues a year ago pointing to these very problems. So this was not something that showed up at the end of last year. There was proof or actually people asking for help because of the issues that showed up a year ago.
That may predate what I'm about to say, but that may have come to light after this article was written in The Observer. But department workers discovered the problem on December 12th, according to the Observer. And Marcus Plusha and County Manager Dina DiOrio didn't hear of the problem, according to that article, until January the 4th. And the county commission became aware of this problem in January during a closed session meeting, but it wasn't until February 21st that the public found out. So, Dumont Clark, why the delay?
Well, I think it was actually the first meeting of the we were informed at the first possible time that the county manager could inform us, and she wanted to inform us before the and they wanted to also try to contact all of these 185 women before they found out about it by hearing about it through the press. So they did actually a remarkable, phenomenal tracking down of all 185 people or women who had not been sent their letters of notification by the staff in the clinic. But they wanted them to find out from the health department first before they found out from reading about it, hearing about it on the evening news and being left in a panic.
And I'm led to believe by reading the series of articles that Fred wrote in the Observer that Marcus Plusha, the health director, was in the dark about this until December. And you're now saying, Jim Puckett, that the agency itself was aware of problems dating back to 2015. So why was he in the dark so long?
Well, and that's the question that I want answered. Dr. Plesha did not find out about this till almost eight months after the fact. So there's a problem there. But there were emails, and actually there were more than 185. There were 300 women that dealt with the pap smear issue that we were contacting. But there were emails from employees, as Fred discovered, asking for help about this very concern. The whole notion of how you can manage pap smear tests, et cetera. There was the person who was tasked with that from almost day one when they took the job, said, there are problems here, the process has a problem, I need some help.
So initially Marcus Plusha said that none of the 185 women had precancerous results in these pap smears, despite the delay of finding out their results. Has that turned out to be the case, Fred?
I don't know the exact numbers. There were women who had high grade abnormalities or the most severe abnormalities, and I'm trying to recall my own reporting, but I believe at least three of them showed to be a condition that's considered precancerous. Now, that doesn't mean they can't seek treatment and have it headed off before they actually are diagnosed with cervical cancer, but there were serious situations involved here.
Do we know, given the HIPAA rules, do we know what the resolution of some of these cases has been?
The county has paid for the women to have new pap smears taken. They've paid for them to have a procedure known as a COPO, which essentially where they go in and they treat the cells that they think are causing the problem. Mm-hmm. They have instituted new follow-up procedures for these women. And so the county has taken very proactive steps to try to make up for this mistake.
So in Friend's initial story about this in The Observer, Commissioner Bill James said that officials discovered the mistake when they stumbled across the fact that the inbox for a nurse responsible for results was just huge with unanswered notifications.
Is correct, Mike, and I think it actually, I think when you use the word officials, you need to be a little, just clarify that. It was the management within the clinic which discovered this,
okay.
And they did not report it until January to Dr. Plesha and to the county manager. So they discovered it. The management within the clinic discovered the failure to send the notices in early December, but they did not notify Dr. Plesha or the county manager until early January.
And have you been able to determine the cause of that overstuffed and unresponded to inbox of emails?
We're going to have a extensive report next Tuesday at the audit committee of the board of directors. And I want to commend Commissioner James, who I think is really approaching this in a very careful and cautious way. He has a background in auditing. He's chair of our audit committee. And I think the county manager, one of the first things she did was to hire Navigant, the consulting firm, and another consultant as well to review all of this information. They're going to be providing us an extensive report next Tuesday at the audit committee meeting, and I'm sure that we will have a much clearer picture of what happened and why it happened after we hear that report from an independent third party.
So initially, Health Director Plesha seemed to position this as an isolated incident. Has that turned out to be the case, Jim?
Well, no. I think that what Fred's finding is there are other issues like this. The problem I have had with this has been, one, the 800 emails were, to call them emails is a little of a misnomer. It's kind of you self-report that within the system. So that's part of the system itself. That's part of what the original nurse said, I'm having a problem managing this. But the fact that you could go 7 months with someone saying I need help and still not discover that, and then go nearly a month after that before the county manager finds out. And by the way, the county manager found out because the director of nursing, once she discovered it, was the first person, I think, who did the right thing and immediately did what her licensure requires, which is notify HR and risk management. And that's when the county manager found. So when you've got a problem that's nearly 8 months old, and you don't, and senior management, meaning the health director and the county manager, don't find out about it, to me, that's the biggest concern we have. And so I've asked all along that we can't just look at the 800 emails. We have to go back and look at the culture within that, and how can you have a department this large, this important, go nearly a year before senior management has some idea of what's going on?
So, Jim Puckett, you called for a state review. Dumont Clark, you said that you urged that Dina DiIorio, the county manager, be allowed to seek a third-party reviewer to report back to the board. I have 30 seconds, literally 30 seconds. What happened? Who reviewed this? Was it an interagency, or did you bring somebody
actually,
else?
Actually, it's both. The state actually came in and did a review, and we're also hired an outside consultant, Navigant, which is doing a review as well, and we'll hear from them on Tuesday. And so far, the state review has, I think, found a relatively, I'm not as up to speed as I could be, but I think it's been a relatively clean review.
Okay. Dumont Clark, District 4 County Commissioner, Jim Puckett here from District 1, Fred Clayson Kelly from the Charlotte Observer. We'll continue in a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Iron Yard, offering full-time web development courses in Charlotte for attendees' career development. Enrollment is open. More info at theironyard.com/Charlotte. Tomorrow on the local news roundup, Clayton Wilcox officially takes charge as superintendent of Charlotte Mecklenburg Schools. Charlotte's homicide number rises yet again. Election season approaches, and we look at some of the stories developing in the various races, particularly in the mayor's race, which now boasts 6 candidates at last count. And the legislative session winds up in Raleigh. Our roundtable of reporters is set to talk about those stories and more on the local news roundup tomorrow on this program at 9.
I'm Ray Suarez. Coming up on the next On Point, the most expensive, least efficient healthcare model in the developed world is ours. How did we get here? That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
Stay tuned for that conversation on Point from 10 till noon following Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Dumont Clark, District 4 Commissioner. He joins us by phone. Jim Puckett, District 1 Commissioner and the Vice Chair of the Mecklenburg County Commission. He's in our Spirit Square studio along with Fred Clayson Kelly, a reporter for the Charlotte Observer who has been following this story since it broke about the problems at the Mecklenburg County Health Department. And as this story developed, Fred, a picture was painted of an organization at odds with itself, at least at odds with the direction in which Dr. Plesha apparently seemed to want to take this organization and the rank and file. They were concerned about patient care. Dr. Plesha seemed more concerned about prevention, health care and prevention. Would that be accurate to say?
That's a very accurate picture of what was going on. I think what you had happen is Dr. Plesha, viewed by many people in the county as a visionary, had a vision of doing sort of big picture ideas, anti-smoking campaigns, healthy food campaigns on one side, and you had nurses who comprise much of the department feeling like we need to concentrate on the basics, like we're not even treating the patients who come in our door as well, so we're going to really have a hard time going out to, you know, a major city and treating the whole city well. And so you had a number of them feeling like we have lab errors. We're giving people the wrong results when they come in for pregnancy tests, for STD tests. We have long lines. We have people come in for their appointments, but the wait is so long, they just leave.
Was he aware of these concerns?
I believe he was aware to an extent. Was he given the full picture? Probably not.
Why not?
Well, one of the complaints...
How can you expect a guy to lead an organization if they're not telling him what's going on below him?
Well, a lot of times within the organization, if you talk to many of the employees, they say honesty is not rewarded. In fact, it's punished. There were a lot of people who feel they were very afraid to deliver bad news within that agency. Some of them said they went to Dina DiIorio and other officials in the county, and there was no response. There was only critics. And that created a further culture of silence. Let me give you one example. You asked earlier about were there other problems besides the pap smears. You know, we just wrote a story last week in which it was noted that there was a review that found there were widespread problems in which patients were likely harmed by substandard care. Afterwards, we got, you know, complaints from Dina DiIorio and others in the county about the story. They complained about the number of people with the pap smears. They said nothing about the fact there was a review that said you gave substandard care.
Yes, Julie Seacrest, an agency nurse, compiled a report after reviewing the records back in February and wrote, and I guess this is what you're referring to, wrote that the problem is much worse than I was told, and it includes poor performing employees, bad supervision, bad data management, bad clinical procedures, bad initial assessment of the problem, bad triage, and incomplete corrective actions. Patient care has been poor at best, and at worst, patients' health and safety has been at risk.
The fact that you,
Mike,
can put
let me just jump in and say that I think that's you know, there's no question. Jim and I, and we all agree that this clinic was very badly managed, and that the care was very substandard. Absolutely no question about that. Three or four of the individuals who were involved in running it are no longer with the county. They resigned. Let's just leave it at that, okay?
Why should we leave it at that? How do we know that solves the problem?
Right.
Oh, I'm not saying it solves the problem. I think what will solve the problem is the county manager's strong commitment to correcting the problem.
Well, we just heard from Fred. We just heard from Fred Kelly that people in control in that agency made their complaints fell on deaf ears at the county manager level.
I think what you heard Fred say was that the county did not respond to the allegations in the Julie Seacrest email, and he was seeking a response to that. I think what they were responding to was the inaccurate reporting in the Observer that another 115 patients had not been notified. And I think they were rather disappointed that the Observer would not accept the correction. Maybe Fred wants to respond to that.
Yeah, because there's no correction to be made. It's accurate. I mean, I stand by the reporting. I've talked to the people within the health department. And I know Dumont's position on this, but I'm also certain that he hasn't talked to the people in the department who actually do the work. But we have, and we stand by our reporting. And the Observer's been around a long time. We're very responsible. This is actually a very conservative paper when it comes to using anonymous sources and things of that nature. And again, much of the reporting has been confirmed and verified with public documents and interviews with public officials. You just heard Dumont say that it was substandard care. What am I correcting?
Yeah, I agree. No, I agree. And let me give you one example, though. I think the Observer has blatantly misrepresented the findings of the HR department's investigation on numerous occasions, as if it were somehow saying that the senior management at the health department was lax and lacked urgency, when in fact the HR department's finding related specifically to this clinic only, and the Observer simply refuses to acknowledge that.
Jim, are you on the same page with your colleague?
No, Dumont and I are on different pages here, although I will say that Dumont and I both absolutely have a commitment to serving the public. We just have, you know, very often different views of how to do that. And by the way, that's the way the system's supposed to work. That's why we have, you know, elected officials with different views, because we hope we cover the waterfront that way. My problem is that you can't have this type of issue in a clinic that serves thousands of people and say somehow or another it's an anomaly, especially when it goes over almost a year's period of time, and go, there's nothing else there. When you have people talking
I'm not saying it's an anomaly, Jim.
but when you have people talking about the lack of interest, and our HR department did talk about a lack of urgency. This is after the investigation of the problem. So when you have a culture that basically says you've got a serious problem, the public is concerned about it, and there remains a lack of urgency in that very clinic, that speaks to my concern, which has been the management
altogether. Let's define the term clinic, because the health department runs a number of different locations. When you say clinic, are you talking about all those locations or one particular location?
Well, this was, and you might correct me if I'm wrong, the HR department was reporting on just the pap smear clinic, correct?
That's correct. Two clinics. One on Bates Ford Road and one at Billingsley Road.
Right. And so but again, my point being that was another red flag, one of many for me, after it breaks. Now, if you had had an HR report that in the middle of last year said a lack of urgency, you'd go, that's probably what led to this.
Talk to me about the swimming pool situation, because it was revealed last month that a lot of swimming pools, public pools, had not been inspected, even some pools that had been, I guess, cited for safety and or health violations at the end of last swimming season. They were just allowed to open without any further investigation on the part of the health department. Why and how is that possibly allowed to stand?
Well, that's the state allows that to happen. The swimming pool issue was not as big a deal to me as others. It is a bit of a concern.
But some of these pools had electrical violations.
There were ridiculous parts of that. I mean, so that's not any doubt whatsoever. Of course, when you look at the thousands of pools that we deal with, you know, it goes to my point of there are issues broader than just the clinics. And maybe as Fred has talked about, there was kind of a taking our eye off the ball, which is the making the trains run on time and protecting the people. So that's a part of that. That shouldn't happen. But it really is tough to tie those two together, other than to say that you would think once you're on the front page of the Observer and you're the lead story on major news networks, everybody in that department should have an understanding that anything you do, be it a pool inspector or a restaurant inspector, you are probably under a microscope. That's the concern you have.
Do you have confidence in the health department right now, today?
I have confidence in the nurses and the people who run it. I do not have confidence in the management of it, because I haven't seen a significant enough change to warrant that. My problem has been all along, there has been a hesitancy to admit there was a problem within the culture. There was a hesitancy to say there was any problem with the mismanagement, and I think there's clearly mismanagement.
Hesitancy on whose part?
hesitancy on both the county manager, who initially, when we talk about, you know, DeMott said that the county manager invited the state and the consultants in. The fact of the matter was that was after about an hour-long debate at the dais, maybe 45 minutes at the dais, when I innocently, truly just said, hey, why don't we just, to make sure the public feels comfortable, ask the state to come in. Now, DeMott was right. He had a better solution, which was consultants. I can talk at length about why I think we have the wrong consultants, but that's not my opinion. That's the county manager's call. But there was a reluctance. There was the county manager, I think, you know, said that she felt confident she could handle this, that she had it under control. And so there has always been a little bit of a reluctance to let people come in and see where the mistakes were.
Let me mention once again that I'll come to you in a second, DeMott, but let me mention once again that we invited both outgoing health director, Dr. Marcus Plesher, to join us, and also the county manager, Dina DiOrio, to be with us. And both of them had conflicts because they're on vacation. So, DeMott Clark, let me get your perspective on this now.
Well, I first of all want to say, Jim, I think it was an excellent idea to bring in an outside party to review. One of the reasons I wasn't exactly thrilled with the idea of having the state do it is that the state actually came in and did a reaccreditation of our health department in 2015, which makes you wonder how competent a state review would be.
And by the way, I've spoken to two senators about that because I think there is a problem there also. I didn't mean to talk over you, but I think you're right.
Sure, but that's what I really wanted was an outside private sector consultant to come in and do a good review. And I thought that was a good solution. I want to give Jim the credit, though, for pushing us to do it, which I think is very helpful. But I also want to say I think the manager is strongly committed, very strongly committed to this. And I want the public to know that we have an extremely capable person now in charge of our health department on an interim basis, who formerly headed up the Wake County Health Department. She's a nurse for many, many years, and she also headed up the health department in Buncombe County, two of the larger Irving County.
You're talking about Alma Gibby Harris. She was the North Carolina Health Director of the Year in 2011 when she was health director for Buncombe County, which is Asheville. She's been working as a consultant with Praxis Partners for Health, which is the firm the county paid to recommend management changes.
Well, actually, that's a two- or three-person consulting firm that she and another expert in this field formed. So,
Well, is that the firm that you're referring to, Jim, as being the wrong firm to conduct this?
And maybe I shouldn't say wrong firm. The problem I have is we hired two consulting groups, Navigant, who, by the way, Navigant has come in to look at how we're structuring the health clinics. However, prior to us hiring Navigant as a consultant, we hired a contract person from Navigant to run our clinics. So essentially what I have is a contract employee from Navigant who came in to restructure it, and then we're hiring the consultants to say whether they're doing a good job or not.
Well, you and Commissioner Pat Cotham at one point were concerned about this conflict of interest.
And the conflict is the other.
And WFAE's health reporter Alexandra Olgan spoke with Gibby Harris, the health director, the interim health director, about those concerns, and here's what Harris told her.
Well, I understand, considering everything that's happened here over the past month, the concern about conflict of interest, and I don't believe that is a concern. I have removed myself from any further assessment work. That is not my role now. My role is as the interim health director. So I have severed that particular part of the work that I was engaged and involved in, and I'm now just focused on the organization. So I guess I don't believe it presents a conflict. I think the little bit of time that I did have getting to know the organization gives me a leg up on getting started in this role. And what I ask of staff and leadership here in the county as well as the community is just a chance to make a difference.
But that has not helped you overcome your initial reservations, because, Jim, you just told me off the air that you believe that she should have stayed a consultant and not become a member of the
staff.
Yes,
the problem I have with this is that it's a bit disingenuous to say I've now discounted myself from the research that we've done because that's completed. The problem now is I have a report that I have not seen, DeMott has not seen, the public hasn't seen, the Observer may have seen, ironically, because they requested it, but it's a draft report. So the outside third-party independent consultant becomes an employee directly reporting to the county manager. I think Gibby Harris is a very intelligent lady, and she's very competent, but she should have been offered an extension or a change of scope of her work worked as a consultant reporting to the board, not as an employee now reporting to the county manager. We could have kept her intelligence and all her experience, but had her not report to the county manager rather than us.
Do you share those concerns, DeMont Clark?
I really don't. I've heard my colleagues say the optics are bad and the optics are more important than facts. But frankly, maybe that's true in politics and seems to be true in our national politics these days when facts are just not important at all. But I think they're not. Facts are important in good governance. But I frankly think that, I have always felt that public health is the most important thing that we as a county do. Frankly, it's sort of the bedrock on which civilization rests is good public health. And I was very concerned that if we didn't get someone very competent and knowledgeable and in place on an interim basis quickly, that we were really going to have a problem. And the problem was just going to get worse.
So the bottom line is trust, public trust with the health department. And our reporter also asked Harris about the quality of care at the health department clinics and about whether patients can feel assured that they're going to get their test results in a timely fashion.
I do believe so. The systems that have been put in place at this point not only are pretty concrete, specific, but they're being monitored on a regular basis to make sure that staff and is following through the way they need to. So I'm feeling confident about the care that's being provided in the clinics right now. The other thing that we continue to try to do is go back and make sure that we haven't missed areas where we might still be able to have positive impact on patients that we've seen in the past. But as we continue to do that, I really want to stay focused on the future and making sure that we have those processes in place and that they are monitored on a regular basis to assure they're occurring the way they need to.
So let me share with you an email from Gil that came in earlier in this conversation. It seems that a lot of the onus on the recent transgressions at the health department had fallen squarely on the shoulders of the health director. But as the county's board of health and governing body, what role and responsibility do you share at the county commission level in the recent events taking place there? And how are you planning to work as the board of health to ensure the community's public health regains the high level of care it has been known for?
Well, I will say the way I do that is I am constantly asking for us to be completely transparent. The optics are important. They're not more important than facts, but you have to regain the trust. The second thing is I think we need to return back to having a board of health that is made up of people within the health profession. I should not be in charge of it. And even worse, we have delegated that to the county manager, which is an even further direction from where we need to go.
DeMont Clark.
I think our job is to hold the manager accountable for correcting the problems wherever they exist, whether it be with inspecting swimming pools, whether it be with providing high-quality care in the clinics. I think we have to hold the manager accountable for that, and I have no doubt that we will do so.
DeMont Clark is Mecklenburg County Commissioner representing District 4. Jim Puckett is the Vice Chair representing District 1. And Fred Clayson Kelly, the reporter that has been recovering these problems at the Health Department extensively since the very beginning of their announcement back in, I think, February from the Charlotte Observer. Thank you all.
Well, thanks for having us.
We're coming right back. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Charlotte Eye, Ear, Nose, and Throat Associates, providing solutions for pediatric and adult allergies with treatments from OTC medications to immunotherapy to surgery across the Carolinas. Details at goodsenses.com. One of the talking points in the healthcare debate is that America has the best healthcare system in the world, but we pay more for care and die younger than those in other wealthy nations. So coming up next hour in 20 minutes at 10, On Point and guest host Ray Suarez look at how our healthcare system became so expensive and so inefficient. By the way, you're invited to join WFAE and Charlotte Talk next Tuesday, July 11th, for a public conversation on Charlotte's growing homicide count and the impact this violence is having on the city. CMPD Chief Kerputney and others will be on hand for that discussion at Friendship Missionary Baptist Church. We start at 7 p.m. More information available at WFAE.org. We're coming right back.
How do you save a struggling family grocery store? First of all, you find a product everybody can buy.
But you have to be 21 to buy a beer. If you sell sodas, if you have the money in your hand, you can go anywhere and buy a soda.
I'm Kai Risnall, a one-stop shop for soda. Next time on Marketplace.
tonight at 6:30 following All Things Considered on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE.
It's listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Charlotte Talks continues now. Obituaries are published in almost every newspaper in the country, but when it comes to the famous athletes, actors, performers of all stripes, major leaders, it is papers of the stature of the New York Times that even other news outlets turn to for the obituary of record. Marguerite Fox has written more than 1,200 of those obituaries for the New York Times. She is featured in a documentary simply titled Obit, which will be screened by the Charlotte Film Society tonight at 7:30 at Wells Fargo Auditorium at Knight Theater. And she joins us now to talk about the art of her craft. Marguerite Fox, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much, Mike.
Is the screening tonight or is it tomorrow night? Which is correct?
Friday night. 7:30 at the Wells Fargo Auditorium.
Very good. I knew I'd gotten it wrong. Well, I'm sure that when you started your career, that writing obituaries was not necessarily your ambition. In fact, in introducing a review of the movie, NPR pointed out that the joke used to be that the obits desk at the newspaper was where old journalists went to die. Writing obituaries was seen in the news business as a punishment and not something people wanted to do. But I get the impression from watching you in that film that it's turned out not to be the case for you.
Well, that was historically the case at any newsroom in America, that obits was where they put you out to pasture if you were a hair's breadth away from needing an obit yourself. Happily, that has never been the case in our pages and in those of some other major papers. And frankly, it is the best job in journalism and the only job that I ever wanted.
Really? Why is it the best job and why the only job that you wanted?
Well, if you think about what an obit does, an obit says John Smith was born in Charlotte on January 1st, 1920, and he died in Charlotte yesterday. That gives you cradle to grave, a built-in narrative arc. So obits are, with the possible exception of a sports game story, the most purely narrative genre in any daily paper. So what better job in journalism could there be than getting paid to tell people's stories?
In the New York Times, as every large big city newspaper, there are obituaries that are written by families that appear in the obituary, the paid obituary section. But then there are these obituaries that we're talking about of famous people, significant people, not always famous, but people who made significant contributions to our culture and to our history. How does the New York Times choose who to write about and who not to write about?
Well, indeed, the distinction you made is the salient distinction where the paid obits, which are written by families or funeral homes and can say anything the family wants and significantly suppress anything the family wants, those are handled by classified advertising, and mercifully we still have a stout wall between advertising and editorial. So our side of the wall, the news obits that appear in big type every day with real headlines and real bylines, are indeed based on submissions we get from families. They used to come by fax. Now they come by email, by telephone. Our editors also monitor the wires like AP and Reuters. They monitor the out-of-town papers, foreign papers, websites. So what we say in obits, somewhat ruefully, is presiding over the selection of which obits run each day is akin to running the admissions committee of the most selective college in the world.
One of the things that this film shows quite clearly is process, how the New York Times, and I guess any paper goes through, any reliable quality news organization goes through to vet the information they're going to publish. And you handle this as though it were a breaking news story. I mean, all the facts are double-checked, triple-checked, and you're going through these long series of interviews under deadline, just as you would for a normal news story. And you're not just telling the good aspects of a person's life. You're going to tell the seamy side, if there is one.
That's exactly right. And these obits are indeed normal news stories, and very often for someone who is incredibly newsworthy, for whom we may not have an advance obit on file, these stories have to be written and gotten into the next day's paper, or now gotten onto nytimes.com, sometimes in an hour or less. So indeed, it is every bit part and parcel of breaking news, just like any other story in the paper.
You were trained as a cellist growing up, and you have prior to getting a master's degree in journalism, and I'm told that your musical expertise also led you to focus at least a bit on musicians who find themselves, unbeknownst to them, in the obituary pages. And I'm also told that you like writing stories about unsung heroes, correct?
That's right. All of those things are right. Indeed, we staff obit writers are paid to be generalists and come off the bench and write about anyone. And it's literally true that in the course of a week, we could do a belly dancer, the president of Estonia, the inventor of the crash test dummy. These are literally all people I've done. But by the same token, we each have areas in which we are more knowledgeable. And so it is in our editor's interest to assign people to writers who have some knowledge in the subject. So I do tend to get all of the dead classical musicians.
Right. You're not really writing about death. You're really writing about life and what defines a person's life and what that person did in life to make them qualify to be in the obituary pages of the New York Times. And you wrote an obit, I'm told, that broke the mold on obituaries and set, I guess you could say, set the tone for obituaries of the 21st century. And I'm referring to that of John Fairfax. Who was John Fairfax?
John Fairfax was a remarkable man who was, as we say in the obit, a flesh and blood character out of Graham Greene. He was this rollicking, roustabout adventurer. He, among many other achievements, rowed across the Atlantic single-handedly in an open rowboat, and then, not to be outdone, rowed across the Pacific, which is, of course, twice as wide. And our obit, which happened to catch on when Twitter and other social media were really becoming ubiquitous, tended to break a lot of the rules. And as I talk about in the film, it showed that obits, which historically were reverential, somber, in smaller papers, often even weepy and sentimental, it showed that the modern news obituary, while fulfilling all the functions of an obit, can be as boisterous and rollicking as its subject.
Well, it's kind of a thumbnail biography, isn't it?
They are biographies. One of my sisters is a poet. She likes to enter these flash fiction contests where you write a whole novel in 100 words. She called me once in the newsroom just to say hello, and when I picked up the phone, she said, "So, how's the flash biography business coming?" And I thought, it took a poet to tell me what it is I do.
Wow. You have written the obituaries for people like Betty Friedan and Maya Angelou and Dear Abby and her sister Ann Landers, plus a lot of people that we probably wouldn't know had it not been for reading their obituary. So when you approach somebody that we don't know versus somebody that we really, really, really do know, like a Maya Angelou, is there more pressure for one versus the other, to get it right, to make it interesting to the reader?
There is pressure in every obit to get it right, because obits are a minefield of facts and names and dates and spellings and historical sequences, and any one of which could be easily got wrong. So there is no more or less pressure depending on the nature of our subject. We take them all equally seriously. But what obit writers love best, what I love best, are not the presidents and kings and queens, because they're already in the history books. They're important, of course, but everyone knows what we did, what they did. What we love are these unsung heroes and heroines who, while not being household words, had an idea, wrote a book, invented something that, as I like to say, quietly put a crease in the social fabric. So I've done people like the inventor of the Frisbee, the inventor of Etch-a-Sketch, one that the Times actually put on the front page, a man named Don Featherstone, who was a sculptor for a plastics firm. And in the late 1950s, he took a beautiful pink flamingo, cast it in plastic, and invented the plastic lawn flamingo that changed the way suburbia looked for years.
I'm not sure that's a good thing.
No, but actually that dovetails with what you said before on a much more serious note. We are not in the veneration business, and so our obits are indeed warts and all. And for every charming inventor of the Frisbee or inventor of the flamingo we've done, we've also done Nazi war criminals. We've done some of the great enforcers of segregation in the Jim Crow South. I had the very difficult duty of writing the obit for Sheriff Jim Clark of Alabama.
Right.
And we are obliged to do them because these are the men and women who made history for good, but also for ill.
Marguerite Fox is an obituary writer for the New York Times and is one of the principal people interviewed and covered in a documentary that will be screened tomorrow night at 7:30 at the Wells Fargo Auditorium at the Knight Theater called Obit. The movie's called Obit. It's being screened by the Charlotte Film Society. You have been called one of the six best writers in New York Times history. Obituaries aside, that seems to be, I would want you to write my obituary given that. How did that happen? I mean, that seems to be a very high award to receive.
Well, this was a list put out by the Poynter Institute, which is a media studies organization. And I believe that it was in response to President Trump's taxing the New York Times with, and this is a quote, not writing good. And so, to their everlasting credit, the Poynter Institute put on their website a list that they headlined, Six New York Times Writers Who Write Good. And in the 150-some year history of the paper, there were Meyer Burger was on that list, Isabel Wilkerson, my wonderful present-day colleague Dan Barry, and a few others. So lists, like all lists, they're arbitrary. They could easily do a list of another six, probably 10 times over, and they would be just as good. But it was gratifying and was a very nice, thrilling surprise to find myself on it.
One of the things that obituary writers like yourself have to do is you do a lot of research, and you have to do it very quickly, but you also have to talk to the families of people who are in bereavement, who they've just lost their loved ones, because you want to check facts and simple things like dates of birth, place of birth, who parents were, what they did for a living, to make sure you have all of that right. But you're calling them at a terrible time. What is that like?
That's exactly right, and there is nothing in journalism school and no Emily Post for a social situation that on its face is truly bizarre, because you are cold calling a stranger and in almost as many words saying, hi, you don't know me, but I'd like to ask you some questions, possibly quite sensitive questions, about a loved one you've just lost. And then I'm going to take your answers and put them where a million people can see them. There is no recipe for doing that. But at the same time, we have to have a professional stance akin to that of, say, a doctor or a psychotherapist.
Yeah.
We, of course, need to be as cordial and warm to these people as our professional stance will allow. But we cannot for one minute cajole them, however unintentionally, into thinking we are friends or grief counselors or anything like that. We have to have that detached, disinterested stance in the original meaning of the term.
But these are not puff pieces. These are legitimate news stories. And so if somebody has something in their lives that is unpleasant or unsavory, you have to talk to family members about that to clarify points of accuracy?
Absolutely. We are not in the veneration business. These are not eulogies. These are news stories. All an obit is a news profile. The only truly significant difference between that and a profile of a living person in any other section of the paper is that our subjects are not living. Indeed, the absolute best response to the situation that I know is from my now retired. We all sit 2 feet from one another in the newsroom. We can all hear each other reporting. Dennis, who was the nicest person in the world, but a good newsman with 40 years experience, was writing about some disgraced politician. He was on the phone with one of that man's grown children, and I heard Dennis say, gently but very firmly, "You know, I will have to have a paragraph in there about the 4 months your dad spent in jail." And the family either was going to accept it or they weren't, but he had prepared them and reminded them that what we are doing is reporting what happened, and we have to have complete fealty to history.
I understand that you wrote an article of your own about the documentary Obit in which you appear, and it was headlined, "You've read the Obits, now see the movie." So what do you want people to take away from this film?
Well, the film itself is a really brilliant piece of documentary filmmaking by the lovely young Brooklyn filmmaker, independent filmmaker, Vanessa Gould. And she got onto the subject because she was actually a source of mine. Her previous film is a marvelous piece on world-level origami artists. It's called Between the Folds. And when one of those artists died, she sent around a press release to many papers, and we, characteristically, I must say, were the only ones who bit, because this artist, whose name was Eric Choiseul, was a case in point of the kind of person we like, someone you've never heard of who was at the pinnacle of an arcane,
fascinating professor. With that, I have to stop because we're completely out of time. Thank you for your time. Marguerite Fox, obituary writer for the New York Times, on a subject in the film Obit, tomorrow night, 7:30 at Wells Fargo.